So today is July 2nd, 2018. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison. I'm talking today with Mark Wagner. He's a UW alum, book artist, and founder of Bird Brain Press. And I'm talking from Steinbach Library at the University Archives, and Mark is talking in New York City today. So, Mark.
No, that's a lie. Actually, I'm
Okay.
talking from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where I currently live.
Okay, thank you for correcting me.
That's okay.
So, Mark, I wondered if you could start off by telling us where you grew up and what your family life was like.
Sure. Thanks, Sarah. I grew up in rural central Wisconsin, in Edgar, which is a small farming community, and it's still a small farming community today. I think the sign on the population sign on the town still says like 1,200 people, which is what it was when I lived there. Grew up there at the youngest in a family of 13, and didn't have a lot of exposure to art while I was growing up, but did have a lot of exposure to people making things. Family that crafted, mom sewed. I remember mom taught me how to sew when I was five on the sewing machine. My dad did woodworking. I had brothers and sisters that were always making stuff. So that's sort of the stuff that led to making art for me.
And Mark, what was it like being the youngest of 13 children?
It was probably, you don't know when you're the youngest of 13 children because it just feels normal. But probably roughly equivalent to other people having uncles and aunts, except they were my brothers and sisters. Like a lot of them had left home by the time I was born. I saw them occasionally. I had two brothers, Romy and David, that I would always get confused when one would come to visit. I would use the wrong name since they looked alike. I mean, probably an important thing is that I didn't have very much exposure to art then. Like I was a pop culture guy. I watched a lot of television. I don't remember going into a lot of museums. Didn't really think of art as an option when I was growing up, but it was something that I got hooked on. Maybe my second year in college, which was I didn't start in the UW-Madison. I did 2 years at the University of Marathon Center in Wausau, and started by studying math and chemistry there, which I did okay at. But in my second year, I decided to take a drawing class as a reward for doing well in my first year. And then it was in the drawing class where I realized that, 20 years from then, I would probably be enjoying that more than I would be, like hanging out in a lab. So that's really when I kind of made the switch to art, year two.
And when did you decide to go to Madison?
I sort of always knew that I would go to Madison, after I was done at the Marathon Center. That's a 2 year program. You're meant to get an associate's degree and then, sort of move into a 4 year college. And so I always knew that I was going to go to Madison when I was done in Wausau.
And why did you choose to go to Wausau? First.
It was very close to home. I could live with my mom, and drive to college, which was important to me, coming from rural. If I was, if I'd just come from Edgar, which is a tiny town, and moved directly to Madison, I may have freaked out by the change and being on my own. So Wausau was just a comfortable first step. It was a tiny town to big town is a big change. So Wausau is a small town, Madison is a big town, and then I ended up moving to New York City, even bigger town, and like my family that's still in Edgar, you know, is kind of freaked out at the thought of, you know, a big city like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of stepping stones. I mean, I didn't know I was moving off to New York from Madison, but that's what ended up happening. When I did go to Madison, it was really pretty astounding. I loved it there. You know, it seemed so cosmopolitan, with, you know, students coming from all over the place and different cultures in town, and the big capital in the middle. It was, when I moved there, I thought it was super duper cool, and still think it's super duper cool.
Can you think back to when you were there and what it was like what was going on then?
What was going on?
When did you come to Madison?
I came to Madison and I graduated from high school in 89. My first year in Madison was 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And, for me, it was, you know, just absorbing the city and the big campus, and being in all the art classes. You know, I was pretty drawn in by, you know, by what was on the desk in front of me. You know, I wasn't really reading the newspaper or, you know, super outgoing. You know, I've always been kind of a, like, homebody working on my projects.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, like going to art school and getting to, you know, do etching and then getting to do painting. And then, you know, I wasn't much for attending functions or going to lectures. You know, I never went to a football game when I was in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, it was all about the projects at hand. And the, you know, the group of people that I was hanging out with were like that too. We were all kind of obsessed with what we were working on, working on stuff in class and then, you know, always having projects at home. I remember I was at a party once and I was talking to someone, just a friend of a friend, and I asked him what projects he was working on. And like, he didn't understand what I was asking him because he just had a job that he went to. And, you know, enjoyed watching television. I was making sculptures, you know, in my bedroom out of garbage, you know, dumpster dives, you know, sort of recycling furniture, and, drawings, etchings, paintings, and then. Eventually kind of got, well, I guess my first step towards working in the book arts was I got a part-time job working at the Memorial Library,
mm-hmm.
Repairing books in the basement.
Who are you working with?
With Jim Bass,
mm-hmm.
was the guy who ran the conservation lab there. And I met Marta Gomez down there.
Mm-hmm.
I think she ended up taking over the lab there.
Yes, she works
was,
there now.
You know, I'd been interested and I'd been writing some poetry and, you know, sort of got it in my head that I would publish my own poetry rather than trying to find a publisher for it. And so I saw that on the jobs listing that you could get a job repairing books. And I thought that was cool. So
mm-hmm.
I got a job there. I worked there on and off for a couple of years. And then it was there that I heard that there was a guy in the art department who taught book arts, Walter Hamady. I signed up, you know, it was probably a year into being in Madison that I signed up for a class with Walter, you know, thinking that I was signing up for a class that just taught bookbinding as a craft. And then it kind of started to become a bit of a wild ride after that, you know, because I didn't know about the book arts, you know. I thought I was learning something traditional,
mm-hmm.
But Walter, I mean, you know, the diversity of forms and the variety of subject matters and sort of intertwining of the two. And so when I was, I think I had beginner's luck when I was a painter. Like my first two semesters as a painter, I was making good paintings. And then semester three of being a painter, like I just started sucking. So it was while that was happening that I had started to go to class with Walter. And so book arts kind of took over for me.
Mm-hmm.
And has, you know, remained consistent for a long time, partially because it's just such a versatile form. Like, you know, if you want to focus on the content, you can focus on the content. You want to focus on the structure, you can focus on the structure. If you don't want to do something, you can always find someone to collaborate who wants to do that part of it. So it really, really became a fun home that I enjoyed for a long time, making books.
Did you end up going back to painting, or did you really then focus on book arts?
I tried to go back to painting. You know, this is 30 years ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Almost. No, not quite that long ago. What is this? 19, 20? A while ago. About 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It can change. You know, I've tried to go back to painting, you know, like 5 or 6 times since then, and like have never really gotten into it. I always think that I'm going to find it easy. I buy all the materials, and then I try it, and then I give up on it again and give my materials away. Not ever going to be a painter again. But I still use all the stuff that I do I'm not making very many books these days either, but I still use all of those, you know, all the techniques in the collage work that I am still doing. And do get back to working on books every once in a while.
And you mentioned collaborating in the book arts. What were the parts of bookmaking that you really enjoyed, that you liked to focus on?
It depended on the project.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I did everything. But then I was fortunate enough to, you know, be in a peer group with some really super smart and capable people. So sometimes, you know, if I can work with Jen Benka, with her doing the writing, I'm going to work with Jen Benka and let her do the writing instead of like slogging away at it myself. Not to mention that she doesn't know how to make books. So, you know, when she slaps a manuscript in front of me, that's awesome. Sort of get covetous and start to salivate and tell her, let me make that into a book. So it's probably when, you know, eventually I got together with a group of people and we formed Booklin.
Before we get to that, can I just ask you a follow-up question about Jen? Was she a student here at UW-Madison? Is that how you met?
No, she went to Milwaukee.
Okay.
And I didn't meet her until she was introduced to me in New York.
Okay.
By a mutual friend when she was visiting. And she's an awesome dynamo, really. Excellent writer.
And I understand she worked for Poets and Writers at one point, right? Does that sound right?
Yeah, she was the managing director. I don't remember her title.
Mm-hmm.
She was the managing editor, managing director. She did a lot of their fundraising. Yeah, Jen is a nonprofit bigwig. Like she gets really responsible jobs for really awesome organizations. And they pay her a lot of money because she's really good at doing her job. She's dynamic and super smart and, like, knows a bunch about poetry, knows a bunch about nonprofits and administration and fundraising, and, yeah.
And you said that you were also interested in publishing your own poetry. Can you talk a little bit about that? How did you start writing poetry?
That was sort of one of the high points of me going to school at UWMC was a creative writing teacher there, J.D. Whitney, who was sort of, you know, if I was going to start listing sort of important mentors, mm-hmm. you know, like Walter might be the fourth person that I mentioned, and J.D. Whitney would be the third person that I mentioned. He was this super charismatic, great poet himself, and that was sort of, you know, before I got the art bug, I had taken a creative writing class and, you know, thought that I had the writing bug. I didn't, or rather, it was something that I didn't pursue. You know, like, I write today when I need to, but I'm not a facile writer. I can write today, but it takes me a while. And it's not poetry. I don't pretend to write poetry anymore.
But you did make a number of books that had stories in them, and you wrote a lot of those, right?
Yeah. While it lasted, it was fun. I've, you know, written maybe a dozen short stories mm-hmm. that I like. I've written, you know, a couple dozen essays that I like. A lot of those come out in, you know, I put out in artist book form or zine form. I just went back to making zines recently, to sort of tie into the work that I'm currently doing, which is collage work, cutting up money.
Mm-hmm.
I like writing as a tool, you know, one thing among all the things that I can do. And I can write enough for an artist book, you know, like probably some of my most successful attempts at writing were ones where I was writing just a little bit and then working it into, you know, something that had illustration and design, and it was all working together. And in that case, it made sense that I was writing because I could toy with my writing in a way that I couldn't if someone else was writing on the project.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was working on my books, Smoke in My Dreams, which is, I guess, maybe like my bestseller among my artist books. It was like I needed to fill a gap for design purposes, and so I could come back and write more material to fill that gap.
Mark, you did Smoke in My Dreams while you were here, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I was living in Madison, and I didn't do it for a class.
Okay.
I was done with my education at that point, but still kind of, I graduated, and then I kind of stuck around the program and around town and around campus for a couple of years after that. You know, always had roommates that that were in the program. Kept on, you know, sort of poking my head around the art department exhibits and, you know, stopping in at classes and visiting people on campus. So it felt like I was still in school, but I wasn't. And that's when I did Smoke in My Dreams, was sort of my first project outside of school.
And which, like, where does that fall in your artist books? Like, what number was that, like, approximately? Do you know?
I mean, that was my second edition book. My first edition book was, I think it's in the Kohler collection. I know it's in the Kohler collection. Travel by Dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Just a skinny little thing that I did as a class project. That was my first edition book. I think I made 20 copies of that. And when I was done, I took it to show Bill Bunce at the Kohler. I remember I was really nervous. And Bill was a great librarian who really built the collection of artist books, or started building the collection of artist books at the Kohler.
Mm-hmm.
We'd gone to visit him in the book arts classes, you know, real, real awesome character. But I was nervous because I knew that Bill sometimes bought work that he saw.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, like, my clothes weren't very good because I was a sloppy college student, but I wore the best of them. And I was sweating on the way, and looked at the book, and I thought at best he was going to tell me that it was worth maybe $30 or $20, and when he said, if you told me this book cost $120, I would not hesitate to acquire it for the collection. And I thought that I was, like, $120 at the time seemed like so much money to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought that I would, like, that day was sort of the first, that was setting the hooks for me being a book artist for a while. Because it was really, like, the indication that it was viable, that people, not only thought it was cool, but valued the activity. So I sold my first book to the Kohler for $120. And like, that's really like an important motivation for, me having spent, the next 15 years pretty much just making artist books and also just making a living off of artist books. I mean, for me, selling books is an extension of making books. I never, I taught classes occasionally, but not very often. My living money for 15, I wasn't born wealthy. I don't have a trust fund. It was making books and selling them that, paid my rent for a long time.
And what did your family think when you told them that you sold one of your artist books for $120 to the Kohler Art Library?
My family was kind of inattentive about my art career at the time.
Uh-huh.
My dad died when I was a kid, so I never had, like, a father who would disapprove of me being an artist.
Okay.
I've heard people say that, oh, my dad didn't want me to be an artist. My dad didn't have anything to say about it.
How old were you when he died?
I was 13 when dad died.
Okay.
And mom was, miscellaneously supportive. She didn't go to college herself, so couldn't really advise me on careers or education, and was, I'm sure mom would have just been proud of me no matter what I'd done. So, and the rest of my family, didn't, if they were bothering to disapprove of my career choice, they weren't mentioning it to me at the time.
Did they help you when it came time to going to school with, like, applications or anything like that?
No. I have got one sister that's, like, my sister Mary Wagner,
mm-hmm.
who when I was in school, I always called her my cool sister Mary. She was, she would be number three on my, important mentor list. Mary was always supportive.
Mm-hmm.
She's a graphic designer herself. So, it was seeing her work as a graphic designer that made me kind of, like, interested in art when I was, six and five. No, not quite that young. When I was 10 and 11. It was seeing Mary's portfolio from when she was in college, where I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. It was like my first exposure to typography as art and, just assignment work for her, but, super cool when you're, stuck in central Wisconsin, in eighth grade for me. Mary was always supportive and, would give me actual feedback and, would come to my art shows in Madison, because she lived in Chicago. Mary was a good bolster, all along. And then I returned the favor to her, at several points in her life. At one point she wanted to quit her her marketing job, and so I taught her how to do handbook binding. So she had a cottage industry making fancy journals for rich people for a while. And now she's got a burgeoning art career. I call her my protege now. because she's really, in the past 4 or 5 years, she started making these drawings after, you know, years of being out of art school and a couple years, you know, since she had been making her journals for people. And now she makes these abstract geometric drawings, and she's getting really good at it. And she's doing a lot of them online, and she's selling work all over the place herself. So, Mary has been a constant since, you know, my whole life. It's
awesome. Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned a few people who are on your list of influential people. Who is number one on your list?
Oh, I just pulled the number five out of my hat.
Okay. I didn't know if you were thinking of somebody, if there was somebody that was like kind of that you had in mind as being at the top of the list.
No, the top of the list kind of shifts around from day to day.
Sure.
Or year to year.
What about,
There have been great people in my life, you know, and great people connected with the book arts too. Hamity was great to work with. Christopher Wilde was really important to me in Madison, and sort of as a friend, mentor, and collaborator. Marshall Weber,
mm-hmm.
who I'm not sure talking to Marshall would be in your sort of purview of Madison artist bookmakers,
mm-hmm.
because he wasn't making artist books in Madison, but like a month after he left Madison, Marshall taught non-static forms,
mm-hmm.
In the art department. I took a video art class and a performance art class. It was just a non-static forms class. So, you know, we did a portion on installation art and a portion on performance art and a portion on video editing and video art. And Marshall was a, you know, sort of became a key figure in my life, and, you know, is still, you know, I'm still interacting with him and learning from him to this day. It's funny because it's, you know, book arts and mm-hmm. non-static forms seem like they're far apart technologically speaking,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's like printing and bookbinding are very object oriented, and like performance and video are so like sort of electron ephemeral. But Marshall's class was literally the classroom right next door to Walter's classroom, you know, and the two things both are time-based, and the two things are both subject, not subject shy, you know, like you can really get into subject matter in an artist's book in a way that you can't in like a painting, you know, and the same with a performance or a video. I remember Marshall had moved to New York City and Christopher had moved to New York City. I think that would have been in like 1998 that they both moved. And I remember the phone call from Christopher saying, you know, Marshall decided he's a book artist. And at first it seemed ridiculous, and then it made perfect sense, you know, because he was, you know, he just hadn't been making books until that day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Marshall and Christopher and myself, you know, when I moved to New York City, and that, you know, kind of Booklyn started to form around that time. And we became the core group to, you know, the core of the core, I guess. You know, Christopher and I lived together in a loft in New York, and Booklyn happened in our living room. That's where we took the meeting. That's where, you know, the big shelf of books was. You know, that's where the curators would come by to look at books. You know, that's where the sales calls would be made from. Christopher was instrumental in starting that. And, you know, Marshall's still, you know, that's his job to this day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been working solely for Booklyn for the past 20 years. Selling artist books, you know, to hundreds of institutions around the globe.
And Christopher did share his story about how it started, but would you like to talk about what you remember, how it started, how Bookland started?
Yeah, sure. It was, I mean, there was a, you know, the niche for Bookland was that there were loads of people making loads of different kinds of books, but no one, and institutions who are interested in collecting those books, but dealers, you know, sort of failing to bridge the gap. My own work looked traditional enough so that I had other book dealers.
Like
my, you know, Califia Books sold my work, and the Hellers out of D.C. sold my books. But, like, Christopher's artist books didn't look like, you know, traditional books. They looked like zine, mashup, you know, trippy, gorpy. Like, they weren't sort of, they were more vigorous than well-mannered. Like, you know, prior to, I would say, 1990, you're sort of, most book arts were sort of still focused on the fine press tradition. But, like, all of these other things were starting to inform book arts. You know, it was the start of, you know, desktop publishing. And, you know, the start of the internet, so people were even kind of questioning whether books were going to survive. So there were lots of people kind of getting experimental and weird, Christopher among them. Like, he, you know, before Christopher was taking classes from Walter, you know, Christopher was publishing his own, like, Xerox zines. And so I told, Christopher and I were in a painting class together. And I think we were both becoming disillusioned painters at the same time. And I was like, oh, you're making these books. There's this guy at the other end of the hall, you know, who's teaching people how to make books. You should go take classes with him. It's great. And so that's where he sort of crossed over, maybe. And then we were all working on it together. You know, after that, Christopher's series called The Tragic Book, which, you know, was sort of the opposite of a comic book, was a tragic book. Things that are so tragic that they're beautiful or funny. You can see in his series of books, like, it's like kind of made at Kinko's, made at Kinko's, made at Kinko's, and then he takes book arts classes, and it's like the first stitch binding that I did for him. And then the next one has weird metal covers and, like, you know, a lot of hand attentions. And then the next one is triangular and has hard covers and fold outs. And, like, it sort of goes from this, like, little seed, you know, into this, like, gigantic thing that, you know, you could hurt somebody with if it fell on their head. That's a digression. Oh, so Bookland, like, a lot of the people that were selling artist books to institutions were just, like, selling things that looked like normal books. You know, they were kind of, I'm going to say, too well-mannered. They were well-mannered. Like, the letterpress was nice. The binding was by some famous binder. You know, they were pretty. But then, you know, people like Marshall and Christopher were making, like, kind of edgy, maybe, might be close to the right word. They were, you know, their books, the bindings were a little bit janky sometimes, but, like, the imagery was compelling and the subject matter was compelling. And, you know, some of them got political, some of them were weird. But Bookland became sort of a conduit for stuff like that. So all these artists that didn't have representation, you know, sort of got together and loaded up the suitcase, and then Christopher or Marshall or Sean would, you know, call up the institutions and make the rounds and show what was new. And that's where Bookland started. Being located in New York City is a good place for something like that because, you know, in New York City, there's probably 12 collections in that city that acquire artist books of one kind or another.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one institution likes poetry, so you pack the poetry for that place. You know, another institution likes one-of-a-kind books, so you pack one-of-a-kind books. So Brooklyn, non-profit organization that, you know, serves the artists that it's selling. And, you know, Brooklyn put a lot of money into a lot of artists' pockets. That was sort of our main raison d'etre. You know, we also had an educational bent. You know, we wanted to educate the institutions about other kinds of books that they weren't seeing in other places. So at different times, you know, different people at Brooklyn, you know, it was important that, you know, we brought along the weird books, even if the institution, you know, didn't necessarily think they wanted to acquire them. You know, maybe the third or the fourth time they saw it, they were like, oh, well, we better have one of these for our collection because, you know, obviously this person means what they're saying. At different times, Brooklyn's sort of dabbled in things tangential to artist books and the art distribution of artist books. You know, like almost everybody who makes artist books, it's not the only thing they do. You know, they make artist books and they make paintings or whatever. They make prints. So Brooklyn sometimes is, you know, like a, sometimes like another art dealer,
mm-hmm.
Showing things tangential to the artist books. It's served as a curator to, you know, create and shop around exhibitions to institutions. A couple years ago, Brooklyn curated the first ever exhibition of artist books in Beijing at the university there,
mm-hmm.
Which is pretty astounding feat.
Yes.
Like, they actually had to, I don't know the correct terminology for how, you know, their cultural affairs organization works over there, but they actually had to create the word, like the letter form word or zine.
Oh,
in
cool.
order to complete the wall text, like they didn't have the word zine. So
uh-huh.
someone created the word, and now that's the word zine over there because Brooklyn organized this exhibition and put a zine in it. It's been pretty cool, you know, like it's cool, you know, in the same way I imagine that having like a grown child is cool. You know, like, hey, my kid's out there, you know,
uh-huh.
doing that. That's crazy. I haven't been directly involved in running Brooklyn for a while now, but I'm glad that it's still out there.
Can you talk a little bit more about your role, kind of when it started, and how your work fit into what was going on there too?
I always thought of myself as like the Marx Brothers, the boring one, Zeppo. Like, I was the most technologically savvy, you know, in the group.
Mm-hmm.
I could bind a book. I knew design. You know, I knew traditional design and could apply it better than some of the others. You know, like. So on a lot of the collaborative projects, you know, like I would clean up messes and sort of rope in the what's the right word? The exuberance.
Mm-hmm.
I would rein in the exuberance a little bit to make it a little bit more, you know, like palatable to normal book lookers. I did some of the boring things in the organization, like I ran the finances for a while and, you know, wrote checks to people and did some of the, you know, technical writing for the organization, you know, like writing mission statements and like communications. I never did the I didn't like, I went on a couple sales calls, but it wasn't sort of my, it wasn't my forte. I did a lot of the letterpress printing. I brought a press with me. It was a press that Christopher and Sean Schooler and I purchased from Karen Heft back in, I want to say, 1996, that I sort of got better at than the others. So I brought that to New York and, you know, printed business cards and printed covers for people. And at one point, I sort of stopped publishing my own artist books and just thought I would publish artist books for Booklyn. So I did that for a couple years. At one point I was the, you know, we were all on the board of directors, but that was kind of mushy. You know, we all just shifted roles for a while. You know, like Christopher was our main sales agent for a while, and then he, you know, he put that in the back seat, and Marshall was our sales agent, and then we were always, you know, when it's your organization, you can call yourself whatever you want. So I was director of publications for a while. I was associate. Sometimes we just called each other Booklyn. Hey, Booklyn, how's it going? fine, Booklyn. It was sort of we all got lucky when finally cell phones dropped in price and we could get cell phones, because, you know, for years I picked up my home telephone and said, hello, Booklyn.
Oh, wow. How long did you do that?
I want to say for like 3 years or 4 years, which I tell you, when you pick up the phone and you say, hello, Booklyn, and it's your, and it's your other book dealer on the line, and they think of Booklyn as the, you know, the weird guys that are encroaching on their territory, it becomes a little bit awkward.
So the number that, if people wanted to contact Booklyn, they contacted you using your home, they were contacting you at home.
Yeah, they contacted Christopher and I at home.
Okay. So you were roommates?
Yeah, we were, Christopher and I were, when I moved to New York, it was a little bit like me moving home. Like, you know, half a dozen people that I'd loved in Madison had moved to New York. Christopher had a great loft apartment that he was living in Brooklyn. And a couple roommates moved out from that loft apartment just when I realized that I should move to New York. So I moved right into, you know, this awesome loft, which I didn't know how awesome it was until, like, I looked around and saw the shitty places people were living in New York. Yeah, and it was very much like a homecoming. You know, moving to New York was easier for me than it should have been. Like, having years later, having to actually look for an apartment in New York, you know, and go through that grueling thing, I was like, oh my God, I'm so glad that arriving here was easy, because this is not an easy place.
Was it just the two of you then in the loft, or were there other people, other roommates as well?
It was the two of us in the loft then, in a space that had been occupied by three people, so there was enough room for Booklyn there for a while. I don't remember exactly what year we finally kind of kicked Booklyn out, and they moved to an office down the street that they only just now moved out of. Like, they were in the same little office for what must have been about 12 years, 15 years. Finally, Booklyn's moved a little bit further out in Brooklyn.
Well, I kind of want to go back a little bit, Mark, if you don't mind. And I understand that you were an assistant to Ruth Lingen for a little bit. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I started working for Ruth when I hit the ground in New York.
Okay.
I had heard about her in Madison. I think my understanding was that Ruth is sort of a little bit second generation Walter Hamady, because Ruth worked for Joel Wilfer, and Joel Wilfer kind of worked for Walter, like, or studied under him. So in a way, I think of myself as like third generation Walter Hamady, because I studied with him directly, but then being in New York, you know, like Ruth and I had Walter in common, and could talk about sort of the greater circle of the formerly Madison book arts world, you know, which was really a thing in the outside world, you know, because so many of Walter's students had gone off and like formed their own institution or gotten jobs at this institution and that institution, you know, like. I think it would be tough to overstate Walter's like effect on the book arts world, because you know he was like, people loved him, people hated him, people had great stories about him, made great work, and so when I moved to New York City, I'd met Ruth before, but Christopher introduced me, and we hit it off. Ruth liked to hire Midwesterners because they had good work ethics. So that got me halfway in the door. And then I helped her out with her own projects. Ruth works for Pace Prints and has for a long time and still does. And she's, she's an awesome master printmaker with, you know, amazing kung fu moves, you know, in regards to all things relief printing and paper making, and this was really, I was lucky to work with her. Had a great time working with her when I was working with her. You know, I did letterpress printing for her, and a little bit of bookbinding, and a little bit of box making. I would go in, you know, she would have her regular day job at Pace Prints, and then I would go in around 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock after her regular work day was done, and she would be engaging on her second work day, which would be switching to her own projects. And so I would work from like 4 or 5 until like 9 or 10 with her, you know, printing some project, you know, one of her own publishing projects. And it was awesome, because there we were at Pace, and like, you know, on the other side of the room was some gigantic Chuck Close print that someone was, you know, had been working on for a year and was still working on it. And you know, Ruth would always sort of toss off these stories of, you know, working with all of these amazing artists, you know, like blue chip artists, you know, just stories about Jim Dine and Louise Nevelson and like Klaus Oldenburg, and like she knew those people. She worked with them. She made some of their best art. So it was kind of really like a magical New York thing, you know. But also, like, Ruth is such a, you know, such a straight shooter, you know, so kind of like Midwestern herself, and like no bullshit. And then on top of that, to, you know, be getting money, you know, she was paying me to work for her. Awesome. But then also being able to pick up on what she knew a little bit. So yeah, had some good times working for Ruth. I worked on books like Chuck Close books that she was publishing. I went out with her to the tip of Long Island one summer for a couple weeks, working on a paper pulp project, a Chuck Close paper pulp print that she was editioning. I mean, don't tell her, but I would have worked for her for free. It was great. And just the best boss ever. You know, like, Ruth would let us, you know, we would start drinking beers after I got the last setup on the letterpress for the day. Yeah, excellent.
And how long did you work with her?
I worked with her off and on for, you know, 3 years, 4 years. You know, part of me wished that I just, you know, I like my job as an artist now, you know, like making art and selling it.
Mm-hmm.
But part of me wished I would have, like, just, you know, signed up with the Ruth Lingen cause and been, like, a good technical person. It's something that I've always enjoyed, you know, like, I like letterpress printing and making it look nice and kind of perfect, you know, like, and I sometimes when I go and visit Ruth and she shows me like the awesome project that she's troubleshooting, you know, with Shepard Fairey, then I'm like, oh, that would be so fun. It'd be so fun to be Ruth, or, you know, to be Ruth's assistant now,
mm-hmm.
you know, and be there doing that. So
Mark, I just want to clarify, it sounds like then for the daytime hours, were you working on Brooklyn projects, and then in the evening hours you were working with Ruth during that time?
Yeah, I would work for Ruth maybe 2 or 3 nights a week.
Okay.
And during the daytime hours I was working on my own artist books,
mm-hmm.
Or working on sort of Brooklyn related matters. I wasn't very employable outside that. You know, I didn't pick up any computer skills in school. So, like, a lot of my friends moved to New York, and they all had, you know, part-time jobs doing computer work, you know, at banks that were lucrative. But I didn't. Sometimes I would do letterpress printing, like, job work for people,
mm-hmm.
For money, but... you know, at that time in New York, you know, with Brooklyn going, you know, I was just making artist books and selling artist books, and that was my, you know, that was my paycheck. You know, sometimes I would get, you know, sometimes I would get paid from one of my other book dealers, but we were living cheaply for it being New York. Young, didn't have very much, you know, I didn't have an expensive lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, because I couldn't, like, I couldn't, there was no job I would be able to find on a job listing. You know, like, people didn't need letterpress printers at the time, you know, which, you know, people weren't looking for bookbinders at the time. So it was just, you know, self-employed, which is kind of what I've been, you know, apart from working for Ruth, apart from, like, a brief stint doing job printing at a letterpress shop, you know, I've been self-employed since Wisconsin, since living in Wisconsin. That's what it is, you know, being an artist. You know, you're just self-employed. You're an entrepreneur. You know, you're
mm-hmm.
You're a small businessman.
How do you kind of deal with the ebb and flow of money and, I guess, projects and everything?
You try to keep money in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
You try to make, I mean, what I did was, you know, I look at all the, I do things that you don't learn in school. Like, in school, there's, it seems like a lot of teachers tell you to, you know, like, follow your whim. And, like, make the artwork that, you know, that you feel you need to make, and make artwork for yourself. And Walter used to say something that drives me crazy, and I think was just bad advice from him. He used to say that if, you know, I don't even remember how he put it. Like, if you don't need to make it, then go do something else. You know, like, for him, he thought there needed to be, like, a drive, you know, like an unstoppable drive to need to make art in order to make it,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't think is necessary. It's not right. You know, I don't know. I can list more artwork, you know, that I want to make than I have time to make it. So I just make that list, and then I go through and I pick out the things that I consider to be the best bet on selling, you know, the things that would be the best bet, you know, on most popular. It's what I've always done. One of the reasons why I made books about libraries was because, the librarian selected the books to go into the collections. and it's a common enough, area where, lots of people's Venn diagrams cross across, this subject matter or that subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I do it. I just try to, you're just practical about whatever you're doing, If you've got money in the bank, then you can spend some time, experimenting and finding something new. If you don't, then you're just like, look at your list and see like, I bet people would really like this, and then do that. Eventually it was economics that led me away from making books as my main income source. Because my collages started to be successful. And when, I can make a collage and sell it for, the same price that, 10 of my books would cost. And I was like, okay, now I'm doing this mostly. But still, still I apply the collage to bookmaking too, and have some projects that are, collage plus the books. I make catalogs from the collage work. I make zines about the collage work. I've done some overprinting on currency, that expresses itself as a book or as a portfolio print. I put books in the collages, in some of the collages. A lot of the collages are, have text. Like the book works.
Did you specifically take collage while you were in art school?
I did. It was a direct influence from both Christopher and Walter.
Mm-hmm.
Walter made those awesome assemblages. Which I really loved. I really loved the design of those. I loved all the materials. And so it was sort of, I'd been collecting garbage for years, just like pulling stuff out of people's trash that I thought were interesting, like broken chair parts and machine parts and clocks that I would take apart. And so I had all these things around that I liked, but I had no idea what I was going to do with them. And sort of when I got exposed to Walter and saw his assemblages, I was like, oh, I can make stuff out of those. That's a good reason to have them around. Back in Madison, I was doing a lot of experimenting. I was making some sculptures that, looked like knockoffs of Hamity sculptures a little bit. And I was, doing collage with a whole bunch of different materials. And then I ended up doing a lot of collages with Camel cigarette boxes because I had a bunch of friends that smoked, and so they had Camel cigarette packaging that just piled up, like a package a day from three people, and you have a lot of materials. So I started using some of those in both individual collages, and then I use those as like the basis for materials in some book in a couple books.
Mm-hmm.
I think Travel by Dancing had some little elements from a Camel package, and then Smoke in My Dreams was sort of about smoking and about the Camel package, and each of those had a complete disassembled package in each one. Including there was one part that I didn't fit into the illustrations of the book. So I glued it underneath. You can see it's underneath the back cover. You can see the silhouette of the piece. And so it was the classic. It was using the repeated Camel package that sort of eventually led into what's sort of taken over my creative life for the past 15 years, which is cutting up dollar bills.
Would you like to talk about that now, or would you like to break here and talk about that next time?
I could talk about it now.
Okay.
If you or did you have a time limitation?
No, we can keep on going if you would like to talk about your collage work. I'm interested.
No, yeah, now's a good time. I was making collage out of a whole bunch of different things, and then I wanted to do some super formal pieces. And for them, I wanted super recognizable pieces of paper, and also very kind of formal pieces of paper. So the first one that I made, I cut up my diploma from
You
the
did?
UW-Madison into little thin ribbons, and then bent the ribbons down as I was gluing them back into place, and made it sort of warp as though it were blowing in the wind. And then I cut up my high school diploma. And then I settled on the dollar bill as a super common piece of paper, and didn't know what it was leading to. Just made a bunch of little formal. The early pieces looked like they were just photoshopped dollar bills, because it's twisted or bent in half, but it's all cutting the bill into thin ribbons and then gluing them down in a shaped manner.
And what made you choose diplomas and currency for your collages? Because I think most people would consider those off limits. So what made you go for those?
I wanted something official.
Okay.
I wanted something. It should be no, I mean, no commentary on my time at UW-Madison. I know this is about that. My piece of paper, my diploma never did anything for me, because I didn't get an academic job. I didn't get a job. My education there was awesome. I loved my peer group, loved the classes, had a great time. It was affordable education. Great setting, yada yada. But the piece of paper was, kind of nothing to me. But I realized that to lots of people, it represented, something important. So that's why I chose that. And the dollar bill, kind of the same. People liked the camel collages that I was making because they knew the camel package, especially the camel smokers. So, if cigarette smoking is a smoker's thing, dollar bills are everybody's thing. We all need to interact with that piece of paper, on a daily basis. And at the same time, no one ever looks at the piece of paper. If you ask someone to draw a dollar bill from memory, their drawings look ridiculous. They don't know what's where. They know that there's a guy in the middle, in an oval, or is it a circle? So it's this, it's this interesting piece of paper that we have in our hands. It's a publication, it's like a little handbill, like advertises America every time you glance at it. It's a really storied little thing. I wasn't thinking about any of that when I started cutting them up, because I've been working, it became apparent to me. I'm a slow learner. I thought I was just making cool little formal pieces when I started, but then showing them around to people, along with the other work that I was making. People were always gravitating towards the currency work, and kind of ignoring the other things that I was showing them. And so that just started to take over more and more. I'm a big fan of the market and letting the market decide. Partially because, because I've had contact with Brooklyn, you know, like, oh, this, you know, Marshall comes back, you know, he unpacks the suitcase and I'm like, what did they think of this? Or you go to a meeting and you can see someone ignoring something or someone paying attention to something else. And I think, you know, that's a, you know, people's pocketbooks are, you know, interesting tells on what they're interested in. So, you know, I used to make loads of different art, you know, I would make, you know, even my artist books, you know, like, put two sequential artist books of mine on the table, and like, if you can't read my name on them, they're like, oh, that's a super formal little thing, you know, and this one has a lot of painting and hand attentions, you know, and this one is conceptual, and this one's just photographs, like a lot of, I was happy switching from one thing to another thing for a long time, and then the currency collage just like kind of wiped everything else out. Partially because it's itself very versatile, you know, like the little formal thing that I was making out of individual dollar bills turned into doing portraits, and those turned into doing like little allegorical scenes with George Washington. Those turned into doing crowd scenes, and, like doing a portrait turned into doing full body, you know, like things the size of doors. And I realized that, you know, anything that I can draw or anything that I can't paint, I can render out of like little scraps of paper, little scraps of currency. And so that's what I've been doing for 15 years now.
And can you explain your process a little bit about that? How you put those collages together?
There's a sort of laundry list of approaches to it, you know, that I've added to, you know, just from longevity. You know, I used to think that I'd sort of reached the end of it. You know, like when I was making, you know, I remember when I made my first portraits, and they were like, it was a basically like an 8.5 by 11 inch, you know, board that I was working on, and it took me 30 hours to make. You know, I used to think that was the pinnacle of care and like concern and attention. And then I realized that, you know, oh, no, that can scale up even further. You know, sometimes, you know, most of it starts by taking dollar bills or a stack of dollar bills and cutting them down into their sort of constituent parts, you know, separating out line work, you know, long, skinny line work into, you know, the cubby holes in the little tackle box, and separating out the leaves into another little tackle box, and separating out the little seals, the Treasury seals and the Federal Reserve seals into another little compartment. And then, you know, pieces of the bill get subdivided, you know, like George Washington, you know, in the heads box, there's maybe 20 little sub drawers, you know, one of them just has four heads in because his forehead is a certain shade of gray that doesn't appear anywhere else, you know, and another one has just his cheeks in because his cheek has a dark gray to light gray fade that doesn't happen anywhere else. So it's a process of breaking down and then putting them back together. Like all of those pieces can be involved, you know, assembled in multiple ways, you know, multiple different textures, you know, that are useful here and there in the backgrounds. There's little images that I use over and over again. You know, like I assemble, you know, pieces into hands, you know, left hands and right hands for Washington, you know, and stock those. And so it's after breaking down, there's like a putting back together slowly. And then, you know, a lot of those materials I keep in three-ring binders, you know, texture swatches on thin Japanese paper, you know, so that when I'm filling in the background, I can cut a section out of those, you know, to glue onto the panel that I'm working on.
Do you know how much money you go through to cut up all these pieces and do all these separate works?
I've got a vague notion. I used to have a more specific notion, like back when I started to do the work.
Sure.
I would keep timesheets on the backs of a collage that I was working on, so that I could know how many hours I'd put into it, so that I wasn't, you know, shortchanging myself on the day when I told somebody the price. Other collages, I would keep track of the dollar bills that went into that particular collage, just for a conceptual angle on the piece, you know, not because I was actually concerned about how much it was costing me.
Sure.
The materials don't end up costing that much, ironically, you know, because most of them are used as a single layer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a panel that's 20 inches by 18 inches, you know, probably only has about $50 worth of dollar bills used on it.
Okay.
And you could spend that much money on paint if you were making oil paintings that size.
Mm-hmm.
The currency work is, I like it because, you know, like it could engage in multiple worlds. You know, like there's a gallery that's Pavel Zubak Gallery in New York City that's done good by me selling them, selling the original collages. But also, most of the work that I make, the images are useful as illustrations on, you know, book covers or, you know, in magazines, illustrating articles about the economy. I like that there's a sort of, you know, the fine art world is a good place to get a big paycheck from, because, you know, people spend a lot of money buying something to hang in their third house. But I like that I can also, you know, make a poster and sell it for cheap on my website to, you know, people of modest means who are just fans of the work.
When you make an illustration, are you making it a smaller work then? Or how does that work? Are you getting an image of the actual collage that you're sending to the magazine, for example?
If they've got the budget and the time frame, I'll make a collage if I can.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like portraits, like people, you know, people have a couple times hired me to do portraits for their magazines. But if it's like, a lot of times if an art director comes to me, you know, I'll just send them my catalog of available images,
mm-hmm.
and they can go shopping for an image, you know, if it's an economic, you know, there's a selection, you know, there's probably something that would work for them, you know, if they've got, you know, if they're looking for like a positive image for, you know, a corporate report, you know, they can go through and pick out trees and flowers and whatever, you know, and use a piece from a larger piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the work is pretty detailed, so, you know, even the big work, it's got lots of little, you know, when I'm done with a piece, I go through and, you know, kind of mentally hold up a little 4-inch by 4-inch window and kind of try to make sure that it's interesting, you know, every 4 inches by 4 inches. If an art director, you know, is looking for something, it's likely they can use something, like repurpose something that I've already made.
Okay, that makes sense.
And if not, then, you know, I would consider doing a smaller thing for them, or, you know, portraits. You know, the portraits I have, they've gotten reproduced a couple times. Like, I made a Lincoln portrait maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I didn't realize everybody loved Lincoln that much. But, you know, like, I've made more money licensing that image than I did selling the original. I made a portrait of Trump during the election, because every U.S. election, during the election, I have a voting booth that I put up and then make portraits of the two candidates standing inside the booth. And then beneath each candidate is a separate box with a slit in the top. So it's sort of like, you know, it takes the voting box and turns it into the donation box.
Okay.
Because elections are so about funding. And, but the Trump portrait I burned before the election because he's such a jackass. And I didn't want it to be confused. Like, I'd done portraits of people that I had respected up till that point. Yeah, his portrait has been licensed a couple times. You know, I scanned it before I burned it. It's been published a couple times. And someone bought the charred remains of it, too.
Who bought that?
It was a, you know, I don't know the guy's name.
It was an individual?
Yeah, it was, he owned some of my other work. I talked to his art consultant, who, when I sort of sent out the email with the portrait during the election and said that I was going to burn it, she emailed me back and said, I've got a collector who's interested in buying it, so I guess you're not going to be burning it. And I wrote her back and said, wrong. No one can stop me from burning this piece. I hate the guy. And then she wrote back and said, oh my God, my collector loves it even more. He really wants it now. So he, you know, he paid full price for it, like it was an intact collage, which, you know, is a fair amount of money. And I sent it, you know, I framed it and sent it to him.
Well, it has a story now.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk a little bit about your crossing books? Is that how you pronounce it?
Crossing books. Oh, Xing.
Xing. It is X-C. I said it wrong.
Yeah. No, that's... yeah, that's... Xing is a name that came out of conversations with Ruth Lincoln, actually.
Okay.
Ruth and I, in New York, in the early aughts, like, especially with computers sort of, like, becoming so ubiquitous. We used to joke about people calling themselves designers. So, like, she would say stuff like, oh, we're in New York City. You know, you can't throw a fucking rock without hitting a designer. And throw it hard. And we had a sort of standing rule in the press room that, you know, one thing is that Ruth is a better designer than designers are, you know, like Ruth setting lead type, you know, makes more beautiful words than, you know, people calling themselves designers. So we had something against designers, designers in quotes, you know, Ruth would be hired to do the printing on a job, you know, that was, you know, designed by a designer. You know, and it would look so much worse than the stuff that she would be capable of doing herself. Anyway, so we had a standing rule in the shop that you could never refer to a designer as a designer. You had to call them a fucking designer. And so I eventually started dating Amy Meese, who's a design. I mean, she's my wife now. We've got kids and all that. But when I started dating her, I was like, oh, Ruth, I'm dating a designer. And she was like, you mean a fucking designer? I was like, yeah. And then ever since then, it was like my fucking designer girlfriend. And so when Amy needed a name for her job, she started calling herself Xing Design, with the X replacing the fuck part of fucking. So that's kind of where it started from. Xing Design was sort of the first iteration, you know, and Amy and I would collaborate on projects. You know, she would take care of the computer part and I would do, like, I would print the covers for it or consult on the binding of the projects. Amy and I were, until we had kids and the kids started taking up all of Amy's time, Amy and I were a good sort of dynamic duo of publishing. So Exing Design started, you know, publishing books that, you know, they weren't Booklyn books anymore. Amy was involved in Booklyn too.
Okay.
She did a lot of the design on a lot of Booklyn's at least a handful of Booklyn's publications and the catalogs and printed ephemera from, I don't know, probably circa 2008 through circa 2012, maybe. Amy and I started publishing. We hooked up with some poet friends and published some poetry chapbooks, a series of chapbooks called The Agriculture Reader. And a couple books of poetry, and we started using the name Exing Books. So, yeah, I guess it makes it a little bit confusing for, you know, some people might be, they might know Bird Brain Press, but then I publish things under Booklyn's name, and then I publish things under Exing Books. And a little bit of consistency may have served my career better. But there were some things that, you know, like when it came to publishing the preamble with Jen Benka, the revisioning of the preamble to the Constitution of the United States of America, which is one of my favorite books. Like when it came to publishing that book, it seemed like too good of a book to put the word bird brain on. I thought it was important. I mean, I could have gone either way when that book was on the table. But having Booklyn's name on it seemed like a firmer, better standing for that book than calling it Bird Brain.
And how did you come up with the name Bird Brain Press? Which is a little bit of a tongue twister, I'm sorry.
It's a bit of a recalled expression. It's like an insult calling someone bird brained. You know, and I like that it's a little self-deprecating. Like, that made me comfortable, you know, to be like, oh, whatever, I'm a bird brain anyway. But at the same time, bird and brain are both two positive things. It was alliterative, you know, like, perishable press sounds good because it's alliterative. That probably had something to do with it. And, just sort of random words at the time, kind of.
Okay.
It could lead to some nice, you know, logo ideas that never really came to fruition. I have drawings of brains with wings coming out of them, drawings of, like, one really gross one that my friend Scott Teplin made for me that I was like, because he draws brains that look really, really gruesome, anatomical. And then my friend Sarah Verone, who's a drawer and comic book writer, I traded her some printing for her drawing a logo that's her logo was a person with a bird cage for a head, and they're sort of opening up the door to their head and the bird is flying out. So images like that. That's where that name came from.
Were you and Amy in New York during September 11?
Amy wasn't. She was living in Boston at the time. We hadn't gotten together then.
Okay.
I knew her. She was a friend. I was living in New York September 11th, 2001. Was on my way home from staying at my lady friend's house that night and on the elevated train, you know, on the N train, and we could watch the towers burning on the N train.
Oh, wow.
And I went, you know, I headed home and, you know, woke Christopher up. You know, Christopher was a late sleeper. Christopher would stay up until like 6 in the morning and then sleep until 2 in the afternoon sometime. So I woke him up and, you know, the towers were right outside our, you know, we had a, in, you know, in on Commercial Street, you know, Booklyn's first home, 70 Commercial Street, it's we had a wall of windows, a wall of factory windows that looked out at the, we were half a block away from the East River. And our windows, you know, were the New York City skyline. And the towers were, you know, like out our window. So we were there when they fell, and with, you know, the stuff that followed.
What was that time like for you?
Depressing. Everyone was depressed. The entire city was depressed. New York is, I mean, it's for people that haven't been there. It's got some psychological problems, New York City does. You know, there's a lot of type A personalities there. You know, there's a lot of people who thought they were over it, you know, like 2 days later, like, oh, ready to go on about our business. You know, like, but then, you know, just bad feelings rippled through the city. You know, so if you got in a good mood one day and you went out on the street, you were going to run into someone who wasn't in a good mood and then pick up their bad mood again. You know, it's completely depressing that, you know, our country used the city's grief to, you know, as an excuse to wage war against people that, you know, didn't have anything to do with it. God, we thought the second days were horrible, you know, until Trump was elected.
And you made books that were about September 11th, too. Did you want to talk a little bit about that? Were you seeking out work, or did it just happen organically?
Ended up making two books about 9/11. The first one was with Marshall Weber, called 12/11. That was a collection of photographs that Marshall had taken of flags around the city, which were really kind of great. Like, because he photographed all these, you know, like, sort of ridiculous flag arrangements. Like, there were all these tattered flags, like people had put up flags and then they just got dirty and tattered, and like, just seemed to be some commentary on the disposable patriotism, or, you know, like, you know, patriotism is just like another version of consumerism. So it was a real simple book. It was prints of his photos, contrasted with America the Beautiful, the lyrics. And the lyrics that that people aren't as familiar with, which get really wacky. Like, I can't remember the name of the woman who wrote the song, but like the less popular verses of that song, like, look it up. Like, they get kind of weird. And so, like, it was just a simple little book, but I liked it a lot. And then the other book that I published, again, using Bookland's name because the subject was just, like, too serious to, you know, say bird brain on it anywhere, mm-hmm. was a collection of drawings by Mac McGill. That just had the Roman numerals of the date. Just to give people a little delay, like, you know, people had become so used to seeing, like, 9/11 and, like, thinking they knew what was going on, just presenting the date as Roman numerals. And they were, like, still piecing it together as they got to the title page. And there was a little bit more of a reveal of subject matter. And Mac's drawings he had made, you know, sort of independent of thoughts of making the book. And he had made like a little Xerox zine. And I was like, Mac, these drawings are too good to just be in like a little Xerox thing. Like, let's do this up. And I think we found a nice version of the book that was fancy with letterpress, but also kind of a little bit punk squatter with rivets instead of a traditional stab binding, you know, and that's Mac's aesthetic. Mac lives in a squatted building in New York, and has for decades. and was sort of known as a provider of graphics and, you know, punk, squatter, like housing activist circles of New York in the 90s and the zeros. And so, yeah, I wasn't looking to make that book, you know, but when it was in front of me, I was like, we need to make this book. We need to make it like this.
Is there anything else that you would like to add about that time?
It's there.
And
yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, there's you know, I remember at one point, maybe it was like a couple days after, and the Booklet crew was like sitting around in the living room, and you know, I remember someone saying like, "Oh, are people going to make art about this?" And I guess maybe it was because we were young, where we like we didn't quite know, you know. And then like on retrospect, like yes, of course people are going to make art about it, you know. Like that one of art's jobs is to, you know, think about stuff like this.
You mentioned that the book that you made with Mac was originally a zine, and you had earlier talked about how you were getting back into making zines. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, zines were one of the things that you know, the book arts collection and you know, the sort of institutional collecting world was maybe like not attuned to, you know, that Booklet helped them become attuned to. So, you know, one of Booklet's things early on was that, you know, we would put the, you know, the $5,000 book by Chuck Close on the table, and right next to that we would put a $5 zine, like Xerox zine. It was that whole array. You know, there were so many nights spent at Kinko's, like Xeroxing pages because you didn't have access to a press, or you did have access to a press, but it was too much, you know, too much of the wrong kind of work for the subject matter. And there's cross-pollination between zines and artist books, like zines and traditional, you know, traditional fine press books. You know, it's like they've had children together now. You know, so you see, you know, the innards are a little bit more disposable, but if you pay attention to the covers, they have a nice letterpress printed cover, or a cover that has more hand attentions, you know, then it draws people inside. Currently I like zines as sort of, you know, for a while it seemed like zines had become a little bit too common. But then, you know, in the early aughts, you know, blogs had become so popular, and everybody had their blogs and they were publishing online. And so I thought, oh, you know, it might be time for zines to, you know, be zines again. You know, how nice is it to hold something in your hand, you know, when you're, instead of staring at your phone. So, you know, I had a little blog for a while, and it didn't feel right to me, you know, like, because I liked getting my thoughts out, but I had no idea if people were reading it. And then I was like, you know, I'm writing, you know, the things that I was writing about were my collage work or things tangential to it. So I was writing about, you know, material handling and process and, you know, the nature of circulating currency from one hand to another. And I was like, you know, a blog isn't the right place for these thoughts, you know, like in your hand is the right place for these thoughts. So I just, you know, sort of dubbed a zine title, and I'm working on issue number 3 now. It's called Love Me Tender, and it's about the nature of art and money, so the interaction of those two worlds. So I've got, you know, the first issue is about collage and the nature of collage. It sort of describes a critical framework for discussing all collages, you know, and sort of the breaks down making a collage into its rudimentary stages. The second issue is about the smell of money, called What's That Smell? The Smell of Success. What's That Smell? The Smell of Democracy. It's about how money, you know, is like, smells like the ink that made it, and it's all new. But then if it circulates around, it starts to smell like gym socks, you know, and that's, you know, that's everybody, you know, contributing something to it and making, you know, making a stinky thing that we've all worked on together. And issue three, it's more lighthearted than that. And issue three is about money and magic, sort of relating sleight of hand and sort of confidence games and theft with money, drawing parallels between you know, magic, like black arts, occult magic, and sleight of hand, you know, card sharks and cheating, you know, and also finance, in the world of finance. And it feels really good to be making them as books. I'm like, this is great.
Are you planning to continue the series?
Oh, yeah. I've got the next two planned out after that. And just, you know, I'm releasing them about 2 a year.
Okay.
Is what I plan. And pretty much just to, you know, just to my list. You know, I might put them up for sale on my website, but otherwise I'm just sending them to collectors and sharing them with my gallery to share with, you know, their collectors.
And how many copies are you making of each issue?
200 or 300.
Okay.
Something that I can do, you know, in the studio. Something that I can run off on my home Xerox machine. And, you know, make them feel a little bit disposable. Like, I like my printed materials to feel a little bit disposable these days. So, I like a catalog that has a soft cover that, you know, people are likely to fold in half or, you know, jot notes on, you know, something with thin paper, something that's a little bit more usable and less art worldly fancy. Since my collages have gotten pretty fancy, you know, I like making the things about the collages less fancy.
And what about artist books? Do you think that you'll return to making some artist books, or you don't know necessarily?
I would like to.
Mm-hmm.
It would, you know, I've got some artist books that I would like to make specifically. I just unpacked my letterpress. It's been in storage for 5 years. So now I'm looking at it rather than thinking about it. Literally right now I'm looking at it. I walked to the other side of the studio. There's some things that are involve overprinting on dollar bills,
mm-hmm.
that I would like to get back to, some projects that I would love to make artist books about. And if the sales in the art world ever pick up again and buy me a little bit more time to pursue those projects, then I will turn to them. Yeah, the art world hasn't been kind to us white chip artists recently. A lot of people who are spending their money these days are spending it on old art from the resale market, or, you know, things that have deeper sales records. Yeah, things are changing in the gallery world in New York. You know, galleries are changing shape and function. closing their doors, reinventing themselves. If the sales pick up with the collages, then be happy to devote more time to my fun book arts projects.
Sure. I was wondering if you had any kind of final thoughts, perhaps kind of looking back at your time at the UW and how you think that it affected your career in any way?
Definitely. I mean, I would say it's all about the people that I met.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough for me to imagine how things would have turned out if I hadn't met, at least maybe half a dozen people from time that I spent in Madison. I don't know what things would be like if, Christopher hadn't come into my life, or Marshall hadn't come into my life, or Walter hadn't come into my life. I still work with some of them. I've got some plans going on with Scott Teplin, who went to Madison. It's almost a question that I can't answer. It's like asking, what it's like being the youngest child. Like, it happened that way, and I can't think of it having happened differently.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. Part of me wished I had stayed in Madison. Madison is, Madison's nice. Patrick Flynn, another Madison guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if people have brought him up. He was the art director at Progressive Magazine for years, but Progressive. Great guy, super dedicated to artwork, super happy to help out, give feedback, regularly appeared in Walter's classes to give advice and, give assignments. Not directly involved in the university, but another sort of Madison character that I can't imagine, how I would have turned out if he hadn't made an appearance in my life.
And how did you, you had mentioned Karen Heft earlier. How did you connect with her?
Through Amos Kennedy.
Okay.
Christopher had told Amos that we were looking for a press. And Amos told us when Karen had one for sale. She had two Vandercook SP15s and sold Sean and Christopher and I one of them.
Okay.
For not very much money. It was like $250 at the time.
Yeah, that's not very much money, is it?
Yeah. I mean, now a press like a Vandercook, I've seen them listed for $7,000.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, that was mid-90s versus now. That was before Martha Stewart, wrote about letterpress wedding invitations. That was, the early 90s, and there were lots of trade schools that were just then getting rid of their printing equipment. And high schools, a lot of high schools had, sort of letterpress rooms where they were teaching people the trade at one point, because that was so important to, imaging typography for a couple decades for probably more like half a century, so it was a viable career to, learn letterpress printing. And then it stopped being a viable career as sort of optical imaging took over and computers took over.
Mm-hmm.
But those rooms with the letterpress equipment were still sort of moldering at high schools. And then at one point, people were just giving that equipment away just to get rid of it. And so getting a $250 press was like a thing of that decade. And then, no one was making that equipment anymore, and more people were using it and wanting to use it. So, that's how you get the price hikes with the press.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might be a good place to stop it for today.
Yeah, thank you so much.